All right, well, we're all, I think, all here. So, should get started. And let's see, David, Paul, and I had, a wonderful conversation last week. It was a bit of a men's group. And it was good in that way, I think, like we kind of, particularly in those chapters, which might be around where you're at, Pam, and maybe you too, Jamie. These are the prison chapters and torture and then coming out of prison. And so we talked a bit about all that. And this week, according to our schedule, we should be up to chapter 29 or so, but we're not necessarily all there. Jamie, you were behind last week. Pam, you're behind.
Almost caught up. I'm on 27, middle of 27, almost to 28. I'm getting there.
Okay. Yeah, 29 is a rough one. I'll say. Oh,
great. I know what I'm going to be doing tonight.
And I'll say too, like I had a challenging week and almost starting like the day, like the night of or the day after our last call. I'm fine. I've made my way through it, sort of unscathed, but it occupied a lot of my psychic time and energy. And although I felt like I was, I don't know where the time went. And suddenly it was Thursday and I hadn't read like half of the assignment. So I did read through chapter 29, but the last, I'd say 50 pages were pretty skimmed. So I have the gist of what happened, but I've gotten into the habit the past couple of weeks of taking notes and having more of the sort of the facts and characters and events more sort of sketched out so that we just have that foundation on which to have more different kinds of discussions. But I don't quite have that this time. So I would rely on Paul, David, if you are better caught up or more have absorbed the material more fully to guide us maybe toward like how we could relate to what actually happens, and then from there take the discussion wherever we will. But I mean, even before we go there, I think it'd be good to check in and see like where we're at with the book. It's like Pam, we haven't spoken in a few weeks and a lot has happened in the book. Of course, mixed in with whatever whatever has happened in your life, you've been traveling. So I'm just curious how everyone is doing and where we're all at today, and how we could sort of figure out where our common space is and where the conversation can go.
Cool. Okay. Well.
Yeah. Nice.
I'd be glad to check in first, I guess. I was traveling. I was in Oregon and Washington visiting family, which was wonderful. I've got a sister who has a 16-year-old, a budding sax player. Got to see him performing jazz. I mean, like complicated stuff. And then his sister's 14 and she won the track, or 13. She won the track star. Got to watch her, doing the high jump, and I was playing kind of surrogate mother because my sister mashed her Achilles tendon, and so she was one-legged for quite a while and couldn't really get around much, so I was kind of doing the visiting all the kids, carpooling, all that. So it was really a delight. I'm an aunt. I don't have kids of my own, and it was fun to sort of play that role, but it was exhausting by the end. I was like, I don't know how parents do it. Oh my God.
It is exhausting.
I know, you guys. I just have such respect for parents. Anyway, so that was lovely. And then we went down to see John's. John has a son and kids, and they're adorable. And their 3 or 4-year-old would just cuddle up next to me and just cuddle up with me. And, it was sort of unexpected. And now I want to cry. It was very precious, just to have that. Very sweet, adorable energy. And then we got sick for days and all kinds of drama. And now we're finally back. And then last night, the dog got skunked again within the yard. So the house and her and everything smells like skunk. And I I did some reading, but not a lot. And I was reading quite a bit last night, and I'm using my iPad, and I'm really thinking I want to go back to reading with a book. And the iPad, it's just not the same anyway.
I can't read anything serious on an electronic device. I don't connect with it as well. I mean, I could read, if it's nonfiction and it's just information, I can do it. But if it's something I want to relate to emotionally, I need the material. I need the paper, personally.
Yeah, though this is sort of an experiment. I did it years ago, and I did love how the iPad and the iPhone, I could switch back and forth, and I'd be right where I was page-wise. I was pretty trippy. But no, I think I'm going to go back to books. So, but I'm back at the part where I finished it now, but in the last few days, I'd read the part where he had that boy come and live with him. Mm-hmm. For 3 months, and how much he didn't want that, and you know, and then the shift and the growth around that, and almost getting killed by those dogs, but there were a couple of comments about just, there was one comment, I don't remember what it was, one of you probably does, about the love of a child. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what he said there, what that was?
I think it had to do with being a man, and like being able to earn the trust of a child, uh-huh, something like
right,
that.
Right, 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 yeah.
That being a mark of a good man or something like that, or a real man, something around, I underlined that, I remembered that. And it's interesting having children because like you learn what innocence is actually, mm-hmm, like that we have this concept of innocence, and I didn't understand it. Like, although I, of course, was a child, and so I was innocent, but by the time you lose your innocence, you don't have a concept of what it is. You don't know what you've lost. And it takes having a real child who trusts you, like there's like no withholding of their enthusiasm, their love, their energy, their closeness. And it is very precious. It is very precious. And I know exactly what you're talking about, because I didn't really even feel it until I had my own children, and how much they trust you, and actually what a huge responsibility that is to protect that. So yeah, that's Tariq comes. He disappears for a while, and he's mentioned again in actually the chapters that were on the schedule for this week. So, okay. Is that your?
That's my check.
Good. Cool.
I'm good.
Okay, I guess I can
think
go
Jamie's
next.
Turn.
So
we'll go I by think... who's furthest back in the book.
All right. So I'm in 27, like the end of it, and right when can't remember the guy's name, but where he had his wife sell her kidney and the sisters. So yeah, that was a little shocking to me, but as far as just like regular life goes, I've actually been off because David's mother-in-law is in from Russia, so I've been on a little bit of a vacay, and I just have like a huge list of things that I want to get done, and I'm getting it all done. So that's feeling good, but I'm listening to it on Audible, and my phone keeps dying. I'm using my phone too much, so I haven't been able to listen to it because I go for hikes and I haven't really had my phone. So I've just been kind of unplugging a little bit. But all is good, and as far as the book goes, I'm at the point with the kidney, and you know, so I went through the whole him being in prison again, and it was just, I was like itching while I was reading it. It was so gross. I don't think I could have been able to handle that. But happy that he's out, and really interested to see what ends up happening with him and Carla, if anything ends up happening. I'm sure that it will. So that's where I'm at.
Okay. Paul.
Well, I'm actually staying a little ahead just in case something happens and I don't want to fall behind. So I'm maybe a couple chapters ahead, but I did have some time today. So I was able to go back over and reread and kind of go in depth and make some, you know, notes for myself for this last set of chapters. And even going back and rereading is somewhat of a harrowing journey, you know, taking breaks and getting to a certain level of intensity. And I'd say that in certain ways this past week, there's been a series of incidents in my life, my actual life around me, with people and friends all having either difficulties or troubles or something. And so as I'm reading about Lynn's quality of loves and affections for these various people, fatherly love, brotherly love, his romantic love, his friendship loves, I've just been noticing there was an unusually large number of pulls on my heart with people who in my circle have been experiencing challenges and, you know, spending more time. So I kind of been paralleling a little bit, or using the book to sort of, you know, read into what's going on for me. It feels as if a certain love with a certain person occupies a certain chamber or channel. And then one situation actually involved a dog that I've known since it was a puppy. That I house and dog sit for, and I'd heard from the family that it has cancer, and they just put it down this last Monday. And it's like a whole different sort of channel or chamber of love that's different than I have for humans or fathers, but it's a certain specific kind of love that I have for this dog I've spent time with. So I'm just noticing the varieties of my heart channel, I guess.
Cool.
Yeah, that's cool, Paul.
That's a beautiful, you set the sharing from deeply personal space bar pretty high right out of the gate. So that's nice, Paul. Hi, everyone. Great to be back in circle with you all. And Pam, nice to have you back. And a personal check-in. Pretty much all of my life right now seems to revolve around just living in wonder in this relationship with my son. Life is just using this relationship so deeply to keep me open and in gratitude and in wonder. If I was to share anything from my world, it gives you the flavor of sort of where I'm hanging out. It's just in and around this time with him. And it feels like everything else I do is just sort of like the little journeys out on the spokes, some time away from the hub, and then I come back to the hub. And he's doing very well. And his mom and I think, you know, taking a bigger time frame into perspective, are doing great given what this all demands of us and what it requires of this ever morphing friendship, relationship, marriage in and around being the focal point for us, our relationship with our son. So mom, thank you, Jamie. Mom's in from Ukrainian mother-in-law is in from Russia, which is where she lives right now. And so it's full of all the ups and downs of a parent visit, you know. A little less, none of my parents right now, so it's kind of easy to watch it from the outside. A very rich week since we were all able to circle up last time. And love having this book as a sort of a wonderful thread that either I treat myself in the morning with some tea before the day gets going, or once the family is winding down, the house quiets, I picked up a wonderful and cheap outdoor couch for $20, put it on the porch, And Jamie's even caught me falling asleep literally out on the porch, and she comes rolling in from whatever she's been up to, her third hike of the day or whatever. There I'll be snoozing on the porch with a book over my face or whatever. So these cool evenings before it really starts cranking here in Colorado have just been epic. So, you know, a great location and a wonderful book. And so anyway, this is one of the sweeter spots, this group that we've got going, and I'm grateful to be here.
Cool. Yeah. So I'm wondering what we should talk about exactly, because I didn't think things could get like worse after the prison and that whole sort of harrowing experience. And Pam, you haven't even gotten to that yet.
It's fine. You guys don't hold anything back, okay?
Well, it's okay, but I didn't think things could get worse. Things don't get worse in a kind of graphic sense, but I think they get perhaps worse in this interpersonal, like psycho-emotional dimension, and the world of relationships, all these chambers in Lynn's life that have developed over the course of the book, and which in some way are reestablished and even expanded after his prison time. In these chapters now seem to all collapse. Well, I won't say maybe exactly how yet, but all collapse. And we're left with a man who's very alone at this time. And I don't know how to talk about that exactly, or not that particularly, but how we can sort of keep, I'd like to have an inclusive conversation. I'm more interested in having the conversation with everyone who's here and having the book there to inform and to reflect back wherever we can to it than in necessarily covering the literal book, the literal text. However, I don't want to spoil it, because it actually, I think there is people have different philosophies about spoiling, a book or a movie or that kind of thing. Some people don't believe that it can be spoiled because you'll appreciate it even if you know what's going to happen. I have a attachment, perhaps, so this is, I'm just putting my thing on the table, to not being spoiled, because it's nice to go through the drama. I mean, what else would life be about if things didn't happen in order? if you knew everything that was going to happen, then it would kind of be pointless. So we kind of reenact that when we read a book or follow a story, even if it's not our own. And of course, just appreciating it as a work of art as a whole, it may not matter. But in terms of the sort of exercise of using fiction to think about how our lives actually work and what our lives are about, I would prefer to keep that conversation open so that we don't get kind of into a particular silo talking about some fact or something that happens in the book. But then if that's the case, what is that common ground, or what is that space? And I kind of need to hear perhaps from, like what y'all think and where we might be able to go, because there's a lot to talk about. Even we're already, 500 pages, with all of us, four or 500 pages. So there's plenty of stuff to refer back to. And the general themes, of course.
Marco, I'm wondering though, if you can check in personally a little bit, because you began this by telling us it was a harrowing, difficult week. And
it's great, Pat.
The rest of us have sort of checked in. So that would be my first invitation. Nice.
Okay. I have to, all right. Part of the harrowingness of the week was, I'm going to speak in very general terms, because part of what I've had to do this week has been to think and reflect deeply on my own communication and sort of what I'm actually saying, to whom, when, why. it's been part of like a formal practice through conversations, like structured conversation, one particular structured conversation that I've had on Tuesday. And then it's also seemed to have come up as a theme, like as the content of certain relationships or certain events. So that's, again, I'm deliberately being vague, but essentially what happened is that I learned something about somebody that caused me to have to initiate a sequence of events that I thought when I did initiate them could end in our relationship ending. And that it seemed pretty clear that that's what would have to happen unless I was radically wrong about this information. And it was clear to me when I received that information, what was the correct thing to do. And in connection to that, I had received a tarot reading. Now, I'm not in my life tended to participate in astrology or in tarot or in sort of esoteric arts of reading my life, but I've become more open to that recently. And it was offered to me as a gift, actually, by a colleague and a friend whose wife does tarot readings. And she had done one for me some time ago, a few months ago, which I found very useful, like just as an interpretive tool for my life, and then offered to do one again and did. And this reading, which I printed out, it was like a page long. Like we did it over the, I gave her a keyword. And then she used that to do the reading for me and wrote it out. And it became sort of something that I used to navigate the situation. Like I was able to read the situation or kind of maybe even trust my own intuition of the situation by reflecting back to this reading. And so when it arose, I knew the proper course of action, but I still had to validate it or think it through. And it became almost like a kind of chess match in a way, because if I make this move, then there are these possible outcomes, right? Or there are these possible ways that, like, you know, if you move a pawn one square, that opens up a line of attack or something like that. And I felt like I was in a situation where I had to think strategically and thoughtfully about what I was doing and saying in order to be in integrity with myself and with what I knew, and to also respect what I didn't know, and to respect the other person and the other people in these relationships. So it took a lot, like I said, that was psychically demanding. And at the same time, because I had a sense of rightness, not uncritical, but just an intuitive kind of, yes, I know what's right and wrong in this situation. I know what is the proper thing to do. I felt like I was able to make those moves. Correctly, if you will, in a way that is non-harming as possible, and at the same time acknowledging that there's inherent harm in the situation, which is inescapable to a certain degree. But the question was, how could I not perpetuate it or further it or deepen it? Or because it was the kind of thing that could become a runaway reaction formation type of situation that would entangle me, would entangle a lot of other things, bind the energy, and really inhibit the kind of space and the kind of relationships that I want to create. So that I hope that conveyed something of what the experience was, but. I can't give details. I can, but I'm choosing not to. So I have nothing left to say other than that this is my last sort of commitment for the week, and my last weekend got really there was like a cloud of, just a dark cloud the whole weekend inside me. I really couldn't be excited about anything. We went out in we went out on a nature event with the girls. We did things that should have been fun, but I really couldn't fully be present with it. And I hope that, what part of the reading too was that this would lift. So I'm hoping that that part is going to come true, if you will, now that this sort of, this cloud, and I think it actually is, I think it is. It's, I'm feeling okay about it. And we'll see what happens. I mean, the game is never fully over. So, and that's, I guess, part of the, what the book is also teaching me as I reflect on these last chapters I read, that, you know, just at the point where you think there could be some resolution, it could tie up into some kind of a knot and there could be a happily ever after, it, that
is dissolved.
Yeah, exactly.
So, now, Marco, as you talked about towards the end of what you shared with us, and you talked about how important it was to navigate in a way that didn't further the harm and all of that, I just, what came to me was just how much love, you know, that you're bringing to this situation, you know, this challenge, and so much presence and mindfulness to do this in a way that, you know, is dharmically right, but really loving.
I hope so. I hope that.
Sometimes love's a sword too, you know, but still it's love when it's. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for acknowledging that. I have trouble accepting that because I don't want to get proud, really, and I want to, like, and not because, I think partly because that pride is like a blindness, and that we have to continue being like self-critical, like we have to keep, and I don't mean that in a way that is, you know, restricting necessarily, but I mean part of, I think practice, part of the path is the mindfulness aspect. And that's not just looking, you know, being present when you do the dishes, but it furthers into these realms. And I mean, that's certainly something that is occurring with Lin in the book, is that he's getting signs, he's getting intuitions about like how things are going, what might happen. But in multiple instances, he notices them, but he doesn't notice that he notices them. And he doesn't do something that might alter the course of events. And that's almost the engine of the drama too. What you don't notice and what you don't do. But there was this line of Carla said that if it all, I underlined it, probably won't find it here, but something like, oh yeah, okay, so a person dies and DDA comments that person becomes mature about 2 seconds before their death, like, so in other words, saying that you finally figured it out, but it's not until, you know, you have no more time left to actually live with that maturity, that understanding of life, and she says that like that without something, I'm mangling it, but basically without love, like there'd be no point for love if you didn't keep making those mistakes, if you didn't have something more to mature. And anyway, yeah, that's, you know, I let me complete my sharing. I thank you, Pam, for pointing that out. I'm sorry I can't fully accept the but yeah, thanks for letting me share.
Yeah.
Well, based on the idea of maybe making this inclusive, I think what I was hearing is that we might be able to talk about general themes rather than go by the episode by episode occurrences in the chapter, some of which haven't been read yet by everybody. But I do think there's general themes or universal themes that we could possibly all discuss, if that's kind of the idea that I was hearing coming out. We could name some of those, I think, and avoid spoilers and get everybody to maybe bring in some of what their own experience is. For instance, that pride piece, I think that one of the last lines in the group of chapters before this set of readings had to do with Lynn's body hardened, hollowed out by pride, mm-hmm. as he was basically breaking away from Carla to go back to Bombay, even though she'd essentially pleaded with him not to. Just noticing you mentioned that yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
Paul, you're saying that reminds me of that scene where he's first introduced to that group of men that do a philosophical conversation once a week or once a month or whatever, that we might, the stinky dogs.
Are you suggesting that we might talk about pride and as a general theme, maybe talk a little bit about pride in philosophically, a little bit in the text, a little bit personally, and just see what we might develop on that particular theme, because that's relevant throughout the book wherever you're at, 29, 24, it's there, and it's actually not a theme that I've thought much about personally. Like, I haven't read philosophy of pride or anything like that. What does that even mean, and how does pride play into our experience of life and the decisions that we make and the things that we maybe miss because of pride. I mean, one thing I said, I think just before, is that the pride blinds you. Like, there's a blindness. There's something you're not seeing because you are wanting to feel proud. You're wanting to feel, you know, what is it? There's a bodily thing, right? Like, pride, you stick out your chest. Like, you know, you're you. You're somebody. Like, you have some meaning. You have some presence, right? But there's some falseness in it because there's an effort involved, right? You're it's effortful, and you're trying to maintain something, right? I think we could. Yeah. What do you think?
No, I was only. So this is juicy, and I'm totally cool if the call goes this way. I'm wondering just procedurally, what is the impact of a fixed journey through X many sessions when we actually skip not going through and making the conversation anchored in the real things that happen in the real book together? And I think it's very, I like this as being creative, and Pam and Jamie, you guys, I know how flexible you are. Jamie's already been to one round of sitting through spoilers and things like that. So, I mean, I'm sincerely with the creative consideration about how to do this. I don't know if, Marco, you can speak from having been through groups before where you're working with people who are at different places and how you honor that. But I am kind of curious if we don't do the normal format this week, where does that leave us then when we have four more chapters and in relationship to a fixed journey of so many sessions? So just if that's not too like nerdy mm-hmm. or procedural.
I'm feeling like part of what I'm feeling too, and it's an effect of the events of the last week, is I just want to connect with people. I don't necessarily want to get to them. So I sort of like, this may just be my own need. I just want to like hang out and talk a little bit. So whatever happens is okay. I do think, David, that it makes sense to like figure out how we can circle back, you know, to the story and to the narrative line. This is a fixed journey in some sense. We will get to the end of the book, and we should get to the end of the book. So what if we say this, let's make this one open and then see, and then next week circle back
Circle back on this one next week on the agenda for the
more film? Maybe if we can kind of merge back into our timeline. If that doesn't, like, if that's, and be prepared for spoilers, maybe, like, next time.
Yeah, you know, I guess what I want is, I don't want anybody taking care of me because I didn't keep up with my homework. You know, I don't want to be taken care of. I came to this meeting knowing I would hear spoilers, and I'm fine with that. I'm happy to be part of this. And even when you guys, even when we talk about particular chronological stuff happening, we then typically move into something deeper that doesn't have anything to do with that. So to me, it honestly doesn't really matter. And I would be fine with us going in our normal format. At the same time, Marco, I hear you wanting to connect.
I love that dog. That dog is so freaking welcome in this circle. That's just fantastic. And to be able to know, Pam, that there's just a subtle skunky row, it's just epic.
It's her walk time, so she's letting me know. I'm going to shoo her out.
Yeah,
you guys
cool.
Talk.
Sure.
Come on, Lucy.
Pam is so cool. I'm so glad that you introduced her to all of us, Marco. And I feel like there's just a lot of maturity in the graciousness with which she made that last comment. You know, kind of like, we're all done praising you, Pam. It was very quick. It was a little burst of acknowledgement. No, I was just saying, I really, the way that you balance, the way that you demonstrated like self-responsibility with both humor and also setting a boundary on anyone adjusting and going through discomfort around taking, projecting that they're being respectful to you. That was like 1,000 sort of telling things about your presence and all in one little sentence. It's nice.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah. So I can, if I could, since I went all procedural, I'm like, Marco lands huge for me, and what he's wanting like becomes easily within my field. So I want to make sure that we do really, that we do make space to really connect. And we never, thankfully, this group has never struggled with that. And we've had larger and smaller circles that connect in different ways. But I'm okay if anyone else feels like pulling off of sort of the following the plot outline or whatever, and just, you know, stays real with what's going on, whether it's sharing more or asking for, you know, other people to reflect on something that's meaningful to them. And speaking only as one person then, and about the particular reading agenda to for this meeting, this was a particularly like, I believe, you know, I experienced it as an intense and, you know, a kind of a, it wrung me out in a couple places, in a couple of chapters, and it closed on an absolutely, I think the English use the term, and now I've felt gutted, you know, I mean, it ends in a place of emotional ruin for me. And I cried no less this time than the last time. And so I also have a sensitivity to spoilers in case that matters. And it certainly wouldn't presume to be a caretaking overplay or something. So I'm sure I just talked in a full circle and I'm not voicing in any direction whatsoever. Sorry.
Well, I'm supposing there might be able to be a both and, that we might be able to address chapters and the themes within, not necessarily go into all the details, but they're pretty vivid. So vivid, when I went back and looked at them, I found myself naming the chapters like I would if I was giving titles to my own dreams. You know, like Marriage and Murder, Confessions and Secrets, and on and on. So
you've done some creative reading, Paul. I
totally.
I think you've got some gems in those notes there.
I think so.
Well, in the idea of maybe looking at the flow of chapters and then being able to talk about what's going on thematically or what affected us, and then that might bring in, again, pieces of what's true for everybody. I could say looking at chapter 26, it seems to me that with these marriages and connections and so forth, as people are finding love and beginning to move towards bonding, that there's a lot of soul searching and increased themes of loneliness expressed by Lynn. And with the sort of the joys and stuff that go on with some of the later chapters. So I think we start with chapter 25 this time.
25, yeah.
And in that one, you hear about the proposals on one hand, and then on a big flip, there's the realization, the pursuit of someone who Lynn felt he was set up by. So then you have that need to find out and revenge, you know, and the desire to have revenge, and that was pretty explicit.
Revenge. Mm-hmm. Actually,
I think we could talk about this one. This is this the details here, right? This one, not too bad of a spoiler. We're talking about, is that all right? Yeah?
Go for it.
Yeah, because it follows up on something that's happened previously, been read. It just sort of follows up with the Mauricio and Modena piece.
Yeah. And 25 also, if I'm not stealing the mic, I mean, 25 also had those really sweet moments, you know, these impending marriages and proposals. And I don't know, I just felt like it, taking this particular sectioning as a block, I feel once again led in. I feel like we're in the romance cycle with this author, where, you know, this the eternal cycles that just seem to throb in the collective plot line are now moving to some sort of springtime of optimism. I felt very engaged at the level of being excited for Johnny Cigar, and the wonderful, was it 25 or 26 where the whole elaborate proposal happens? You know, Letitia gets blindfolded and all that. So anyway, that's what I remember, that was strong for me in 25.
And 25 though does start with a theme that is going to come back in each of the subsequent chapters, and that's a death and a murder. It starts with Majid.
I don't know, yeah.
There's a train going, do you hear that?
I love that.
All right.
And they think it's the Shapna, you know?
That's right. So he was killed in a gruesome manner, and not just killed, but slaughtered is the word used. And here might be one of these points we were talking about earlier, where you notice something or you feel like something is happening around you. You feel like you're being led into a situation, but you can't quite grasp what it is. And that's that killing was like a foreboding, right? Where he says that once again, he has a sense of a trap, of a destiny not shaped by my own deeds and desires. It was as if the constellations themselves were just the outlines of an immense cage that revolved and realigned itself inscrutably until the single moment of fate had reserved for me. Majid dies. That shakes this criminal network, because Majid was one of the council members with Kadirbai, right? The theme of death and people dying is that combined with marriage is one of the salient points. Did you have anything else on that chapter, Paul?
When that sense of the trap, another thing that I noticed Lynn saying was that there was too much I would not allow myself to ask. And there's a sense that along with the knowing that he's holding back on asking certain questions, and there's opportunities, and he reflects sometimes on what he doesn't say. And the author is getting me to think a lot about avoidance or denial, or what I think might be polite when I'm actually protecting myself, I might be thinking I'm protecting somebody else or protecting Pam from knowing a spoiler.
Mm-hmm. You know, I watched the Comey stuff today, and he did one of those moves today. Mm-hmm. What did he say? He couldn't flat out say, I'm not going to do the Flynn thing. He just said, yeah, he's a good guy. And he admits during the testimony, you know, mm-hmm. maybe he could have done something differently than that. But you could hear him questioning his own maybe cowardice and how he was handling a couple of those instances with Trump. And I don't mean to get all political, but it just reminded me of because we all have those moments, right? When we don't really say how we really feel about something and we soft pedal it or whatever. And anyway.
Actually, I read the story about that. I didn't get to watch the testimony. I would have if I wasn't in another meeting. But the situation that I described earlier was like a microcosm. Like I felt like it was a microcosm of the Trump Comey thing, where you have, you know, somebody who's just kind of off, you know, unhinged as the person in power. Or the person exerting power in this case, or the figure, let's say the figure of power, and there's a relationship there where it's really truth and power, right? Mm-hmm. And Comey, in this situation, he's not unpowerful, you know, of course, as the FBI director, but relative to Trump, he works for him. Right? Trump is his boss, right? And he's concerned about the untruth that's being potentially perpetuated and the whole cascade of negative effects of that. But he's also trying to play. He's also has to be very smart about what he says, what he doesn't say, how he documents it, and I read that part because it was one of these moments where he could have said, he could have used that sword of like insofar as he's a hero here. And I don't know whether he is or not, like he could be an agent of the deep state, whatever you want to say, but insofar as he does care, let's grant him that. And that he's acting out of some love, some noble impulse that would tend to indicate that you should speak the truth, that you should not hold back or soft pedal. And yet, there's maybe some wisdom in that what he interpreted as cowardice, it might have just been a kind of healthy dose of caution. Because
dealing with a characterological disorder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to me the way that so the murder theme, it starts out on his periphery, and we get to kind of experience the distance he's able to keep from it until it the adumbrations of that as a theme come right into his life. Right, that little boy shows up and warns him that the Nigerians are looking to kill him. Like Nigerians, why? You know.
Can you define adumbrations? What was that word you just said?
Yeah, whether I'm using it in the best sense or not, but in the same way that a pebble when thrown into a pond creates these waves that head out.
Uh-huh.
So I think sort of of adumbrations as sort of a rhythmic, repercussion or a sort of vibrating outward of a central event. So, you know, I was sort of using it in reverse almost.
No, I just have never seen or heard the word. I just looked it up. Anyway, cool. Thanks.
I hope that was in the ballpark. I defer to Mark.
I'm sorry. I had to stop. I was like, a word I haven't heard.
Wow. Yeah. So then, and all of a sudden there it is, right? It's right in his life. And then there's the whole, you know, Maurizio and you know, the stealing the heroin money. And so it closes on murder as well. And I don't know if I'm not, if I'm not picking up on the subtle cues of what we're not saying or supposed to say. So I don't need to say, you know, how 25 ends, but there's, you know, there's a killing in the slum, and it's going to come in as a theme again in the next few chapters. Interesting that, you know, this sort of things happening out there, you know, and how we relate to that. And then when things get really personal, how does it shift the way that we relate to it? And I think that was a theme that touched me a little bit in 25.
And if I can just add a little piece to bringing in that murder in the slum, there's a sense of Lynn offering money to sort of try to help the problem at the same time that we're sensing that he's feeling changed by his new job and he's no longer really a part of the slum. And so, you know, he's kind of going through changes. And I think of that Pride Before a Fall piece. And then the next chapter, which I thought was so rich by virtue of the fact that we get backstories from one of the characters. How do you say his name? Didier?
Didier.
And then we get introduced, or at least I get introduced, a little bit more deeply to Bollywood. Makes me want to go watch a few films.
I wonder if we can find the clip where he's in these films. That would be kind of fun. Didier.
You mean, is he a real person?
He gets a job. He gets a gig.
Did he?
Wait a second. I just thought you meant, I thought I heard Marco saying, wouldn't it be neat to find a film clip in which Lynn is acting in a Bollywood film?
Yes, because he plays he plays an extra
right
in some of these films.
Okay.
So this is not a series. Again, now I'm going to refrain personally from divulging significant spoilers.
I don't care about all this, you guys. No, I should stop.
My own reason not to protect you. Maybe.
Jamie, come on. Get it.
Yeah, I don't.
Oh, we lost you.
Welcome to Say Anything. You know, I sat through it last time and it did not spoil anything for me and actually enhanced the experience of reading it and listening to it because I don't know, I was going into it with a little bit of a different perspective than I usually do when it's just like me and totally fresh, not thinking of it the way that you guys do. So. Don't ever be afraid of spoiling anything. It's tired of
your fault. Thank you.
Okay. So what happens then is that he's talking to Didier at the beginning of this chapter. And if I remember correctly, after that, he gets a call from Lisa or something like that. And she's cleaned up. She was a heroin addict. She's cleaned up. She's looking good. And she's working with the Bollywood industry on recruitment because they often need extras. They need tourists or foreigners who are extras to do their films. So she works with Lynn to recruit these foreigners, to be in these roles. And then later in a subsequent chapter, he ends up in the movies as well as part of a deal. He starts doing some black market kind of things with the producers and they get an in and he's traveling around the world. He's going to Nigeria. He's going to Singapore. So he's really become part of this criminal network in these chapters and is getting good at it. He's learning the trades. He's learning how to do, how they get gold from the Middle East and then melt it down and then resell it. He's learning how to do passport forgery. There was one other particular trade that he learns. Do you guys remember what it was? Oh, you're all muted.
I'm not.
It's because I'm thinking out loud.
Me too. That's a good question.
Because there's the gold, the passports, and it was the job that he actually liked. Currencies.
Currencies. That's right. And then like you were saying, Paul, we learn about Didier's backstory. He had fallen in love with an older man who was like a mentor to him. And he ends up stealing this man's money, running off, seeing him many years later. And this man has become older, and he sees him and he loves him, but he walks by. He doesn't go and say he's back. He's returned to the same town, and this man, what was his name, Ronaldo, is out having, you know, tea or food or something, and he walks on by, and that's like this core moment where he could have turned back to him. It wasn't about the money anymore, but he refuses. And why did he refuse? Because he got older.
Yeah, specifically he was no longer beautiful.
Right. No.
Yeah.
That was so painful.
Yeah. And then am I cutting you?
No. I had something underlined here, and I was just going to offer it.
Please.
The theme of the wrong thing for the right reasons.
Yep. He gets back with Cutter and gets into the moral side of, mm-hmm. you know, his universal view. Right. That's the only thing. That's where I was going to take us next, too.
Okay. Well, go for it.
No, just, you know, kind of along just sort of a playful way we've been doing it in the past is just sort of stating those almost like plot moments, like a summary of the plot moment that touched something, and then seeing what people want to chime in about it. But I thought it was really rich to sort of get that next level, like sort of the continuation of what started out as more of that philosophical debate, Big Bang, and, you know, complexification, or this journey into complexification or novelty, I guess. But this is more like the ethical dimension that they started getting into. And I'd love it if any of us who read that part felt like talking a little bit more about whether or not we're feeling further, you know, wooed by Cutter by, or whether we're feeling at odds with his confidence in this, you know, universal theory he holds.
Well, I guess I can confess that as a general tendency, I have a little resistance to people who put themselves in positions of, you know, high wisdom and authority. They kind of have to prove it to me. So that's just my characterological fixation, questioning some authority there. So I'm, you know, critically examining his philosophy and thought process, and not necessarily as identified with Lynn's desire and want to have this father figure. So just to answer, I think, your question, David, I'm really enjoying the philosophical piece, and that ethical question that he presented I thought was powerful and interesting. But I'm a little standing back, I guess.
I'm much earlier in the book, but as soon as we start talking about him, Cater?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I actually have the exact same. I kind of have this fascination with him. And I'm really curious to see how his actions match with how he's being presented, you know? I mean, you guys are much further along, but where I'm at, I'm like, he sounds like a really intriguing, fascinating guy, maybe a mystic. And yet he's a criminal, head of this whole criminal thing. So I'm like, oh my God, how does this all work? So I'm intrigued and skeptical. Like, is he just sort of a really highly skilled sociopath or something? Or anyway, so I'm curious.
Do you have to go, Jamie?
We can't hear you.
Ooh.
There you go. Nope, can't hear you.
Sorry, I unmuted you, and then you unmuted yourself.
Thank you. No, I just wanted to hear what you guys had to say, but yeah, I mean, just there's so many different layers to this book, and seeing them peel back the layers on all of the different people and how they first appear and then how they continue to evolve. It's just like every time, you know, every page, every chapter, you're learning something new that's, you know, shocking. And, you know, when they talk about the murders and the different things that happened with that, I would have never expected that it would have been who it was. So trying not to spoil that, but yeah, I mean, it's just, it's interesting and cool how people are evolving and changing and how they're just like not who you always expect them to be. So we'll see how it continues to evolve.
Cool.
But thank you guys. It was great seeing you for little bit, but I will see you guys next week.
Very good.
All right. Bye. See ya.
I have to jump off in 15 minutes.
Okay. 15 minutes. So I'd like to comment then on the Cutterbot thing, because you're going to come to a chapter, Pam, where you get the discourse of Cotterby's cosmology, his philosophy, and it's
incredibly,
it's very sophisticated. And what we in how it falls in timeline of our reading is that in the last set of chapters we got like part one of that discourse in this conversation. The whole chapter almost is a conversation between Cotterby and Lin, but then he leaves him hanging on one important moral question. And that question he returns to in the second set of chapters. But what's interesting about Cotterby is that his philosophy is, explicit. He doesn't name names in terms of philosophers that it's influenced by, but there's certainly Teilhard de Chardin in there. There's certainly maybe some Aurobindo. There's a sort of evolutionary cosmology, and then out of that cosmology he derives a sense of morality. And part of what I think we learn about Cotterby is that he seems to be, as paradoxically as it seems, integrated in the way that he thinks about his actions philosophically. So even his criminal enterprise is not divorced from his philosophy. It's an expression of it, actually. And the principles by which he conducts himself as a criminal, mafia boss is consistent philosophically to him. And he explains this. And in these later chapters, the question is, what determines, so he sees the world as manifesting toward or evolving towards what he calls ultimate complexity, and that ultimate complexity is God. And what leads further along that route, what kind of forwards that process, is good, and what detracts from it is bad or evil. And Lin asks him, well, who judges and how what's good or evil? And they get into a conversation in this latter chapter is about how that is and how it's objective in Cotterby's interpretation. And they talk about killing, which I didn't actually make that connection, but in Cotterby's view, killing is always wrong. But you can sometimes do the wrong thing for the right reasons. And that sort of moral paradox, I don't know how to resolve that, actually. But it seems to, perhaps it plays out in some of the events and some of the things that Lin does. Maybe we can talk about that. But it's, I find it intriguing. I mean, it's an intriguing proposition. Because how do we know what actually forwards evolution? Is Donald Trump forwarding evolution, for example? Maybe he is in a lot of ways, in other ways not.
An unwitting tool.
Yeah. And so how do we as mortals with limited perspectives determine whether or not somebody or some action is actually good or evil? We don't totally see the full sequence of events that it's going to contribute to. So I don't know. I don't know if I can agree with that notion of cadre bias. Because I was talking earlier about how I felt like I was doing the right thing, right? In this situation I abstractly described, I felt that way. But how do I know what the full sequence of events is going to be? In the book, Lin does a number of things that are generous. One of the things he does, which is central, is when Prabhakar gets married, he gives him the cab and a license to the cab. So he sets him up to make money, to have a job, and that ends up being one of the conditions that leads to a tragic event. So he felt that was a good thing, being generous, just like I felt like not causing spoilers is being generous or nice to you. But that theme
came up in earlier, because I mean, I just read about that same theme this week. So that's an ongoing theme. How what you think is a positive thing for someone doesn't necessarily for that person turn out to be. I mean, I'm being very concrete about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But there it gets into what's your motivation and what do you have control over? Mm-hmm. You know, if you're doing it for the right reasons and you've done your best to sort of assess the situation, then, you know. I mean, I don't know with the taxi cab situation, I don't know what happened. I don't know if it just was fate and other stuff that caused this tragedy, or if there was a negative piece to this, that had he been more present, could have prevented. I don't know if I'm making any sense. It's hard talking about stuff you don't know.
I think you are. And I wonder if there's something, there's this, like, he senses that he's off. Like, he senses that there's something that he's not aligned with. If there is a good current or a good directionality in the universe, he senses that he's not aligned with it. So it's almost like no matter what he does, even actions that appear to be good and generous, because they're fundamentally coming out of this non-alignment or misalignment, or part of it is the lie that he's living. Like he's living a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And that infects everything, right?
Mm.
So is it possible, like, is it the case then that no matter what he does, he's not right with the universe? And so everything is going to be screwed. In some way or the other, everything's kind of fated to be screwed, right? I'm wondering about this, and I just want to make one. I want to make one more comment here because the thought occurred to me: like, what is reality? And as I'm thinking about, I mean, we've kind of all over the place. We're talking about Trump. We're talking about the book. We're talking about, you know, this my personal life. Family visiting. Injuries, house stuff. I mean, how does it all connect? Like, and I mean, I'm thinking that what if reality is just these stories? Like, and if we have to really learn to read the stories to understand reality and see the patterns that the reflections and the ways that things connect, the tarot reading, the astrology chart, like it all somehow has information. Maybe it's not scientifically verifiable information, but like if we read outside of that scientific worldview, not ignoring that, because science is real, but like what are we reading? Like how do we read our lives? How do we read reality? And I'm just getting that sense. So I don't know.
Isn't that part of what we're doing here? Actually, this, like, who we each are as we're interacting with this story, and with each other, it's like we're exploring the meaning, and the meaning is doesn't happen without us being a part of it and a part of exploring the story.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I want to be doing that. Like that, I definitely want to be doing that. Like, or, I love this book, but it's also, it's also like training or something. Like, you know, like I've looked at fiction that way. Like what we really have to read is reality. Like the book kind of gives us clues or gives us a way of reading reality. But like, if we're really like, what are we doing here together? Like what would be the best thing to come out of this? I think some clearer appreciation for reality or some like greater discernment of the stories that maybe tie us together, that tie us to what's going on in the world, that tie us to like these characters who we've never met, but somehow like we're so intimate with them because a writer has brought them to life for us. And how intimate are, like, how vivid are we for each other? How vivid are, like, what are the stories that, like, why is Trump so freaking vivid? Like, what is, you know, if we were to write the story of our lives now, it'd be, if I turn on my phone right now, if I open up the news app, it'll be Trump going, why is that our story? why did that happen? I don't have the answers. You know, I'm flummoxed by the whole thing. I mean, if I think about why am I doing all this, you know, why am I dealing with all this book group and reading, like to do my homework, like I'm done with school. Like, why do I have to, you know, why is it important to like, you know, to that I, like, why is it important to me, at least, that I show up and that I, and it's like, what, I'm trying to get to something. Right? There's a purpose. But you're all smiling at me. All right. I think I'm just, I don't know what to say anymore.
The question I had back to you was, well, why are you? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this group? Why are you showing up?
I think it's because I was lonely. I wanted to talk to people. Yeah. And I honestly, I think that, I think I just want to talk to people, but what do we talk about? Like, you need to kind of need an excuse to talk, right? I mean, something to talk about. maybe because just my mind, I'm characterologically attracted to books, to ideas, etc. And so I want to talk with other people who feel the same way, and but who don't just see them mentally. Like, not, it's not, you know, it's not an exercise. It's not, I don't know. It's not. I've been in some groups and known some people who really just consume books, and like they don't. It's just another entertainment, right? It doesn't change them, like that I notice, you know, it's just like a habit. And it's a good habit, I think, to have in general. And I don't want to necessarily judge from the outside what they, you know, what it's really about. But I've been really changed. My life has been changed by, and how odd that reading words, text, like change can change your life and change your story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe I'm trying to change my story. Maybe I'm trying to be less alone. I'm not alone in a lot of ways. I have my family. I'm very fortunate. I'm a very lucky man. I'm not a criminal. I'm not on the run. I'm certainly, you know, I'm not experiencing anything near the tragedy and the suffering that Lynn is undergoing in this book. Maybe the pretense of reading a book is not necessary. But Maybe it is. I don't know. I mean, I get you guys are here. You know, you showed up. I kind of got what I wanted talking to you. So that's, and I feel good when I do this, actually. Like when it goes, when I feel it goes well, and you know that you respond, and that's why that's maybe the behind the spoiler thing. I really just I wasn't as interested. Maybe just in I'm interested in doing the book because there is something good about, you know, doing your homework and keeping up and completing something. Like the completion of something you set out to do is satisfying. But within that, if you just lose sight of the underlying motive, which is maybe is connection or connectedness and a shared understanding and like the ways that we expand each other's minds, then like I'd rather have that than completing the book. But I wanted to complete the book too. So where does that lead? Maybe I'm just coming back into a circle. And David's smiling as well. And I'm just curious what's on his mind. There's some thought there. That, yeah.
Very lovable. Easy to take you in and to feel, hear myself in you. And with that kind of rapport with you, and I doubt it's just me, it's then a special treat when you'll take the chance to say things that are very intimate to my own journey, but I wouldn't have either worded that way or that well or whatever. So I'm just grateful. I'm just taking you in and glad that this particular group tonight is choosing to go this way. Just by way of sounding in, based on what hearing you guys talk recently just touched from me in my own experience, somewhat brought into my own awareness through following the news and, you know, just sort of the Zen stick that the mystery of modern politics is for me, together with another particular study group I'm doing in and around exploring what is the nature of authentic prosperity. So it's sort of like a tree huggers or kind of green economy version of a group that is exploring what is healthy thriving from a financial standpoint, what is sustainable, what is healthy money, healthy relationship to money, etc. But so this reading, that group, my own, you know, journaling and musings on staring at, you know, my preferred liberal channels and their take on what's going on right now, I've noticed a central tension between modalities that I've developed to navigate this otherwise overwhelming experience that is an individual incarnation nested in this thing we're calling history, et cetera, et cetera. And it's the tension between, the first one is that I've been brought on a journey in which I've experienced some very big breakthroughs in the domain of surrendering and just being a compassionate witness to the whateverness of, you know, the phantasm, the display, the lila, I mean, you know, couch it in whatever cosmic terms, just this, you know, the mystery of the unfolding of the story of my life and our life and kind of the storyline of giving it historical kind of labels and all that, but just the surrender, which allows it all to be okay as it is. But, and then here's the contrast piece, the tension that I'm witnessing. Then of course there's the other stream of wisdom that's come into my life, and I feel like I recognize it and I answer to it and I'm trying to live into, actually from that place of letting go and allowing it all to unfold as it is, and taking a little bit more of a, you know, sometimes devotional, sometimes just like, you know, brave, you know, just bearing it like from witness consciousness. On the other side, actually being engaged in the individuality, the plight of this individual becoming. So, you know, I had years to wander, you know, much more absorbed and, you know, much less attached to this particular body and this particular gender and whatever. And that was very instructive and fun, but that was sort of the adventure of someone who isn't married and now a parent and you know, taking a stand for creating, you know, would-be mission-driven startups, et cetera, et cetera. So the character I animate is, you know, deeply engaged. And I find, so I'm observing these two places. It's like the first one, the Transcendental Observer, is my go-to for throwing in the clutch when I just can't bear either the hill, the upward or downward. The shit's either coming way too fast and crazy to make sense of, or it's just, you know, it's just, I've bitten off more than I can chew, giving a damn about politics or what have you. And so this, like, this ability to move into, like, loving witness and just sort of, like, saying, wow, God, look, you know, look what you're up to. This is incredible. You know, you know, you're okay manifesting as Trump and manifesting as, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, back over in my daily schedule with my project management system and my 47 things that have to be done and the 3 reports I'm writing and the, you know, I get up 5 and I relate to world economic markets, you know, managing hundreds of thousands of dollars and, you know, and it's, you know, it's just, I'm just bearing witness to this dance. And I'm curious about the entire anatomy of this structure. Like, I'm actually able to say it to you with reasonable clarity because this is sort of literally how I hold it. And then I'm very curious, like, who holds it and which one do you conveniently jump to and when and all that. So the book kind of puts me through my paces, looking sometimes with Lynn and Carter by at the larger philosophical implication of either being okay with being a gangster and trying to find some cosmic parentheses in which it's okay, and then in other moments getting pulled into the ecstatic and excruciating detail of the unfolding story of these you know, sweet characters' lives. And it's interesting how that parallels, you know, our own life. You know, here we get a chance with each other to take in a bigger perspective, but then, you know, we're going to go to sleep and wake up tomorrow and each of us is going to have our to-do list. So I just thought I'd sound off on that.
You're precious.
Yeah. And I'll just notice it, that we're here now. In a few moments we won't be, you know, and
I gotta go too.
And you gotta go.
Goodbye, you guys.
See you later, Pam. Thank you.
See you, Pam. Blessings. Kiss that dog for me. And remember Marco's word, characterology. Characterologically. Oh, I missed her. I'll send that in a text later.
Yeah, people come and go. Right. And that's what, I mean, I guess now that it's the 3 of us, the last few minutes, we can spoil all we want. Yeah. But people come and go. And, you know, these scenes, Leopold's, whole new crowd there now. Carla's gone. Abdullah's gone. Babacar is gone. In the most, what to say? I just read this before starting the call, so I really don't know what to say about Prabhakar, his death and the particular way that he dies. Yeah, I mean, what you're saying about the back and forth and the transcendental, part of what a book like this does, and you know what he does in that scene, that last scene, maybe just touch on this, is he steps out of the story. Like, he addresses, he steps out of the third person narration of his own first person experience and into a direct address to Prabhakar. Mm-hmm. And that struck me so directly, so poignantly. I just read it before, so I have barely even had a chance to, like, I just have the image of him in my mind without his, you know, jaw and without his smile. Like, his smile, like, that's the thing that if out of anything maybe sustained him, you know, sustained on Lynn through all of his tribulations. So
thank you for
I'm sorry.
Thank you for mentioning that he stepped out and addressed directly that. I didn't notice that, but looking back at that page, and now I understand why it gripped me so doubly well, that particular move. I missed it in terms of the literary twist there, but thank you for pointing that out, Marco, because it felt like I could get inside all those feelings that had been generated about Prabhakar, and you know, the hereditary smile, even like it was a lineage smile he got from his father, right, which had caused his mother to fall in love with the father. So something was really shattered there. And then that scene, I guess, where his mother's cutting off her hair, right? Yeah. That was beautifully done.
Maybe in the spirit with which we've closed the last few, maybe just the last paragraph in the...
Oh, yeah. Let's do that.
Can you do that?
Is that good?
Beautiful. You want to wait a second, Paul? Did you need to do something?
I'm going to grab my tissues.
Yeah. I'm just using my shirt.
Yeah, this incarnation business.
Yeah. Totally. You know, one of my teachers wrote a book once called Armless at Last. And it was a really pertinent koan for me. And there was a particular reflective meditation that went with that. Like, if you truly encountered that level of no self-defense, you know, you couldn't fall back to any of the artifices of self-defense in whatever forms they take, embodied, you know, epitomized, obviously, in the title of the book. But where, you know, how far would you have to fall in towards your true nature, you know, to finally just meet life in deepest of surrendered intimacy to however it shows up. So this, the closing of this chapter, just, yeah.
There's one character who does that, actually, just to presence that, because there's a moment when he goes back to the jail, to Arthur Road jail, and he meets...
Don't rob me of this.
Ranish, is his name? The one who killed...
Anand.
Anand, you're right.
Yep, Anand. Yeah, absolutely.
And he wants to help Anand, right? He wants to help Anand not have as hard a time in jail as he had by creating a narrative around him, a story around him, that he's really, you know, was a better guy than it would seem, being a murderer. And that he could be seen as noble or virtuous for what he did, doing the wrong thing for the right reasons, if you will, right? And Anand doesn't accept his gift, doesn't want to help, wants to experience the full dose of punishment, you know, for what he's done. That surrender that I think you're talking about. That's very interesting. You know, that I'm just noticing that. So okay, yeah.
At first, when we truly love someone, our greatest fear is that the loved one will stop loving us. What we should fear and dread, of course, is that we won't stop loving them, even after they're dead and gone. For I still love you with the whole of my heart, Prabhakar. I still love you. and sometimes my friend. The love that I have and can't give to you crushes the breath from my chest. Sometimes, even now, my heart is drowning in a sorrow that has no stars without you, and no laughter, and no sleep.
Thank you, my tour guides, once again.
To you too, Paul.